Thank you. All right, how's everybody doing out there? Good. Yeah, I love the energy this early. Okay. All right, so first off, I just want to welcome everybody to the 51st Conference on Broadcast Meteorology and the 7th Conference on Weather Warnings and Communication. We're really happy you're here. We've got a great in-person turnout this year. Also, thanks to our sponsors. And my name is Danielle Dozier. I'm the Chief Meteorologist at News 19 WHNT in Huntsville, Alabama. Happy to be co-chairing alongside Emily, Zach, and Jennifer this year here in beautiful Myrtle Beach. So again, we welcome you guys for being here. Just a couple of quick notes. If you haven't already, we do have those grab-and-go breakfasts out there every day. So we're excited for that this year if you want to grab a muffin or a Danish before you come in. We're really excited about a lot of the sessions that are happening this year. We've got some newbies. One of them is Out of This World, Space Weather, and that's coming right on the heels of the big Northern Lights event that we just had. I saw those lights out in Alabama, so that was really exciting, and I'm excited for that speaker a little bit later on today. We also have some other sessions lined up for you, so I'm going to pass it over to Emily.
Thanks, Danielle. All right, guys, we've got some local Myrtle Beach flavor that's going to be here with Ed Piotrowski kicking off our conference here with the first presentation, so that's going to be fun. Rob Feller, can't wait to hear from him. We also have our first DEI session for the broadcast conference this year, which, if you're unfamiliar, it's diversity, equity, and inclusion, something that is long overdue. And as part of that session, our keynote speaker, I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, have heard of June Bacon-Bercy, just a trailblazer when it came to the weather community, especially in broadcasting. Her daughter is going to be here today to talk about her life and her legacy. So very excited to hear from Dale St. Clair about her mother, June Bacon-Bercy. Some other exciting sessions on the weather warning side. Jen, do you have anything you want to point out?
No, not at the moment. Thank you. No, I don't. Everyone, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. My name is Jen Spinney. I'm co-chairing the weather warning and communication side of the conference with my co-chair, Zach Reel. We are very excited to be here. It is a joint conference, so this means that at least today, all of our sessions will be hosted in this room. We will be separating for Thursday and Friday sessions, but you can float around. If you find that you want to see a session on the broadcast side, but you're part of the Weather Warnings Conference, come over to this room. If you're from broadcast, but you want to go and see a student present on their research over on the Weather Warnings and Communication side, head over to the room across the hall. Okay, so you can float freely across. We will be joint today and mostly separated for Thursday and Friday, with the exception of the station scientist program or the station scientist session on Thursday afternoon from 1:30 to 3. Zach, did you want to introduce yourself at all? Okay.
Thank you. Yep, so as Jennifer introduced, my name is Zachary Reel. I am also co-chairing with Jennifer for the weather communication side of the house. As she talked about, this is going to be a joint session, so I look forward to seeing you guys on both sides or both rooms here.
Okay, so just a few other things that I want to let you guys know about. We also have the Blue IQ session that is coming up on Thursday at 6:45 in the morning. So if you like to wake up super early, it's going to be a great event. I heard it was already fantastic with the one that was held with Bruckner Chase yesterday. So that's also something that you can still register for. We also have, of course, our lunch provided by AMS on Thursday. And then this year, our conference outing is actually an inning. So no, that's actually included in your registration fee this year. That's going to be held on the property at the Ocean Blue Terrace, which was the outside area right next to the hotel bar. So if you were joining us for our icebreaker event, you're very familiar with where that is. That's going to be at 6:30 p.m. on Thursday. And then also wanted to let you guys know about a couple of other things. We have our event reception and exhibit hall, of course, happening tonight. And then we also have Weather Band is hosting a webinar called Swimming and Beach Safety Perspectives from Blue IQ. That's going to be on Friday at 12:15. So they're going to talk about that Blue IQ session. Okay. Yeah, apparently. Causing a power. Hello. Hell? No, it's back. I don't know. Okay. Yeah, so those are some of just the different things that are happening throughout. And the other thing that I did want to mention real quickly is that the Coriolis Committee is hosting their icebreaker today from 10 to 10:45 during the coffee break. So there's that as well. And that's all I have, unless you guys...
I was going to point out, we also have a designated safety officer this year to keep everyone safe. Bree Smith, please stand up and wave. If you are in need of, she's got you covered. No, if you have any questions about safety or concerns, the goal this year is not to isolate yourself. So that's her number one piece of advice. See her if you have any questions or concerns about safety. She is here for us.
Thank you, Bree. Yeah, sure. We're very thankful to have student weather briefings that will be provided tomorrow, Thursday, and Friday before our morning sessions begin. They'll be hosted in this room. So if you want to come and support local youth, early career professionals in our field, come and listen to their weather briefings. We do have those grab-and-go breakfasts every morning. So you can enjoy your muffin and your coffee while you're listening to the students, hopefully. A couple other points. The restrooms are right outside the WeatherCom conference area. We have water fountains around. There's one elevator, and you may notice that it's slow. And so there are quite a few staircases around. There's a staircase right out these doors here. There's staircases opposite to the elevators, so you can feel free to use those as well and make your way up and down. We will be trying our best to keep the presentations to 11 minutes of talking, presenting, followed by three minutes of question and answer, and then we'll allow a minute or so to transition. So let's try our best to respect our colleagues and allow everyone their space and time to talk and deliver this important information in that hopefully 11-minute time period. What else did I want to mention? Yeah, we did. Yeah. Okay. Uploading presentations. If you have not yet uploaded your presentation and you need to upload your presentation, then we request that you come to the room that you're speaking in the break preceding your session. So if you're speaking and delivering after the morning break, then come during the morning break and make sure your presentation is uploaded and ready to go. If you're speaking in the afternoon today, after lunch, come at lunchtime and make sure that presentation is uploaded. Does anyone have any questions, anything that is unclear or muddy that we can help demystify at this point? No? Okay. I know it's a room full of talkers, and you probably just want to get to the meat and potatoes of today. So why don't I hand it over to Emily? Thank you again, everyone, for being here. I'm very excited for a good few days of conferencing.
Thanks, Sharon. And don't forget to use those hashtags you see there. If you guys post anything on social media, please use the hashtags and join Slack. It's a great community for getting in touch with other people. So join Slack if you can. All right, let's get this started. I want to introduce our session chairs for our very first session. I'll bring up Paul Gross and McCall Fridez. And McCall is going to give a quick little plug for an event that she's planning on Friday, too. So come on up, guys. Thank you, everyone, for coming.
Good morning, everyone. Should have worn my nails. I'm a little short. My name is McCall Brideggs. I am a former meteorologist. I actually worked in Dayton, Ohio, left television a year ago to join Keep America Beautiful. And the reason I bring that up is because the event that Emily was referring to is the beach cleanup that I'm going to be hosting with Keep Myrtle Beach Beautiful Friday morning from 8 to 10, right out on the beach. So if you want to join, you just need to come out there. We'll have all the supplies, and we're going to clean up the beach, making it look beautiful. There will be some community residents that will probably come and help with the cleanup as well. And it's just a really exciting event, not only to participate in something that helps the environment to be sustainable, clean, and beautiful, but also a moment for you to take a photo and share with your viewers back home that you do great things, even when you're away at conference. So that's my little pitch. We're really excited for this session, and I'm going to go ahead and introduce my co-chair, Paul Gross.
All right. By the way, a big hello to you folks from the weather warning community. If there are any two groups in the AMS that really have a symbiosis and need to come together, it's our two groups. So great to be able to do a conference with you guys again. Our first speaker really needs no introduction, especially if you're here in the Myrtle Beach area. This is the mayor of Myrtle Beach. Ed Petrowski is going to kick us off this morning. Ed was also the lead worker to make that golf outing yesterday possible. So thanks for everything you did for that, Ed. That was really, for those of us that were out there, that was a great time. So Ed Petrowski, everybody. Well, good morning, everyone. So great to have you here in Myrtle Beach. My first conference was back in 1997 out at Salt Lake City, and I never thought in a million years that I would actually see the conference come to Myrtle Beach, but here we are, and it's so great to see everybody here enjoying the beach. You've really lucked out with the weather because the dew points could easily be pushing 80 right now, so enjoy the relatively lower humidity that we have in our area. My talk basically is going to be about, I feel like I need a green screen now. I need to kind of stretch up here a little bit. We'll get this going in a second. It's about some of the big weather events that we've had here in Myrtle Beach. Most days are like this. They're nice and pretty, but we've had some winter storms, obviously some hurricanes, and also, of course, a big tornado that came right down the Grand Strand that ended right here at this conference center, if you can believe that. And we've got video of that as soon as the presentation gets going. Here we go. Okay. So that's my name. This is where I work, and we'll talk about Myrtle Beach High impacts when it comes to weather. First of all, the Grand Strand is a 60-mile stretch of beachfront properties from Little River all the way down to Georgetown. Of course, Myrtle Beach is the crown jewel for that. We have 90 golf courses here. It's a golfer's heaven for sure. 425 hotels, 2,000 restaurants. And that basically means if you ate at a different restaurant every single night, you will take 5.5 years to actually get to every one of those restaurants. 18 million visitors, and where they come from? These 10 states are the top 10 states where we get visitors. North Carolina, number one, which is kind of odd because we're in South Carolina. But the point here is that if you live in one of these states, there's a pretty good chance you're going to be recognized by some of the tourists here before the local meteorologists will be recognized. So that's one of those things that you just get a lot of tourists this time of the year, especially as we head through July. Some of the famous things from Myrtle Beach, did you know that Vanna White is from Myrtle Beach, just up the road in North Myrtle Beach, actually? That's pretty cool. Sports Illustrated was founded right here in Myrtle Beach as well 70 years ago, right up at Pine Lakes Country Club in the heart of Myrtle Beach. Some of the other things that we are maybe famous for or infamous for, of course, is the spy balloon that traversed the United States. It was shot down right off the coast of South Carolina, which I thought was pretty cool. And, of course, how many of you remember the red Jeep from Dorian in 2019? A worldwide sensation, and so many memes were made of that particular Jeep for sure. Some of the things you might see on the beach around here if you're up nice and early, maybe a few deer, perhaps a cute seal, but that's typically in wintertime and extremely rare around here, but it has happened. Some of the things you don't want to see around here, alligators, surfing in the waves, that typically happens in very rural areas. And yes, on occasion, there are rattlesnakes that come to the surf as well. But again, that's typically far south of us where we have a lot more rural areas. We have never seen that right here at this conference center, just so you know. For those of you going swimming, don't think twice about it. Something else that especially coastal meteorologists never want to see on the beaches around here, especially during hurricane season, is this guy right here. Right? We love you, Jim, but when you're a coastal meteorologist, we know he is somebody that's bringing a lot of bad stuff with him. So, Jim, we love you. Come anytime after November 30th. All right. So this is what it normally looks like. And the camera that we have for this picture is literally right on top of this building looking northward. So once you leave the conference, you can go to our website and view where you've been anytime you want to do that. So that's Myrtle Beach as you look northward up the Grand Strand and around to Little River as well. So some of the big weather events we've had, hard to believe that we've had a major Christmas snow back in 1989. 14 inches of snow fell in the city of Myrtle Beach. It was impressive. I wasn't here at the time, but I was up in eastern North Carolina where we got even more snow up there. Just a little bit of the meteorology. We had a positively tilted trough, that is, kind of swinging toward the eastern seaboard, became negatively tilted, and low pressure developed right off the coast of the Carolinas. And typically when those low pressures are really close to the coast, unfortunately, we get a lot of warm air wrapped in. We get nothing but a cold rain around here. This particular case, though, the area of low pressure developed farther out over the ocean. And because of that, we were kind of in the sweet spot. We had a ton of cold air in place and a day and a half of snow and 14 inches of snow. Now, for a lot of you that are from snowy markets, you're pretty much ready to go in about a day or two, right? Well, even less than that. For us, it took at least a week to get everything cleaned up and back to normal because we're just not prepared for that kind of snow around here. See some of the pictures. Pretty amazing to see on Christmas morning that there's snow on the beach chairs, snow and drifts on the sand dunes here in Myrtle Beach, and people literally skiing down Ocean Boulevard, this boulevard right out here in Myrtle Beach. Pretty impressive to see that. We are in hurricane country, and we've had some big hurricanes actually hit our coast. Hurricane Hazel back in 1954. Category 4 hurricane slammed into Little River, which is right on the state line, North Carolina, South Carolina state line. 140-mile-per-hour winds. The 106-mile-per-hour wind in Myrtle Beach is still the highest wind gust ever recorded in this city, so it was pretty impressive. The storm surge was really huge. 12 feet for us is impressive, and that kind of storm surge wiped out a lot of the beach communities along the Grand Strand. In fact, 85 to 90% of all oceanfront property from Little River all the way down to Pawleys Island was destroyed by that storm surge back in October of 1954. You can see a lot of the homes that were undermined here. And in Pawleys Island, a lot of the homes that were on that barrier island were literally washed off the island and found in the marsh after that. So impressive how powerful storm surge can actually be. Of course, we had Hurricane Hugo, and I know my colleague Rob Fowler is going to be talking a lot more about Hugo here shortly. In Myrtle Beach, we had a wind gust of 76 miles per hour, but again, it wasn't really the wind. It was the storm surge. Hugo being a perpendicular hit and us being on the northeast side sent a tremendous amount of water ashore, 13-foot storm surge in Myrtle Beach. The Bulls Bay storm surge of 20 feet is still the highest storm surge ever recorded on the east coast of the United States. So very impressive direct hit by Hugo, and this is what it looked like. Garden City, which is about 7 miles south of here, was demolished. A lot of the homes were destroyed. The water went up and over the barrier island and into the marsh, and that's all water damage. That's not wind damage at all. That's just the power of water and storm surge. And then all the dunes in Myrtle Beach were basically washed away by that hurricane as it actually did come ashore. Then we'll fast forward 6 of the last 7 years. We have been significantly impacted by quite a few hurricanes. Matthew, now Irma did not come into the Grand Strand, but it did go up the west coast of Florida. It was so big and so powerful that it literally sent a lot of water into Myrtle Beach in terms of a storm surge. So we still had storm surge coming into Myrtle Beach even during Irma. Florence, I'll talk about here in a second. Dorian and Isaias were sort of those paralleling the coast, still produced a lot of rain and storm surge, and then Hurricane Ian as well back in 2022. This is a look at some of the storm surge associated with Hurricane Matthew in 2016. This is down in Pawleys Island, just tremendous amount of water coming ashore, wiping away a lot of the dunes, obviously doing a lot of beach erosion as well. And a lot of the docks and walkways were destroyed by Hurricane Matthew. Thankfully, at about 7 feet or so, most of the homes were fine because they were on stilt. So the water went underneath a lot of those homes, and a lot of them were spared. Of course, we had Hurricane Ian, a hurricane that was basically falling apart. The Hurricane Center wrote its last advisory on Ian right after landfall. But because it was a perpendicular hit down near Georgetown, there was still a lot of momentum, so a lot of water still came ashore. And this is Garden City, which, quite honestly, will flood if you spit. That's how low it is. But you can see the water coming in up underneath the homes, and quite a bit of damage was done. The homes were safe, but a lot of the cars were either damaged or even totaled because of the salt water. And there were a lot of those associated with Hurricane Ian. Then Pawleys Island Pier, which is down south of us as well, we had enormous waves with Ian, 20 to 25-foot waves, thanks to the onshore flow pushing that. And it took down half of the pier that just kind of floated like matchsticks, and eventually the pier was left on the beach to be cleaned up. They still haven't replaced the pier, but it's going to take some time. One thing about things here in South Carolina, things move pretty slowly. It takes several years, many years sometimes, for piers to reopen. This pier out here was destroyed by Hurricane Matthew in 2016, and it reopened not too long ago, but it's a beautiful pier. And Surfside Pier just down the road also just opened up recently. So we've had a ton of erosion, not only because of hurricanes, but you also know about climate change and sea level rises. So even king tides are causing damaging flooding in our area now. So we have a lot of erosion. We do beach renourishment. another hurricane comes, wipes it out, and then we're right back to where we started. So it's a cycle. It's never ending. And unfortunately, we're eventually going to lose that battle to Mother Nature. It's just a question of when. Then there's Hurricane Florence. Florence was one of those hurricanes. It wasn't a huge deal in terms of wind. It wasn't a big deal when it came to storm surge. Florence was all about the rainfall. And it became very apparent early on that Florence was not going to go out to sea. Most of the hurricanes and tropical storms that get to the point that Florence was here typically go out to sea, but there was ominous signs that a big ridge of high pressure was going to develop to the north of the system, build westward, and block its escape route. And that indeed is what happened. So it was on a beeline for the Carolinas, and at one point looked like it was going to be a major hurricane actually coming ashore somewhere along the Carolina coast. We didn't know exactly where, but it looked likely. And then unforeseen wind shear really helped to weaken the hurricane tremendously, and it came ashore as a Category 1. So there was a collective sigh of relief that, okay, we escaped a big hurricane, but people didn't realize, or seemingly didn't realize, that there was still a huge flood on the way because of the amount of rainfall that was predicted. And I think anybody who's a tropical meteorologist knows that most of the people that die in a hurricane, it's not from the wind or the storm surge or the or tornadoes. It has everything to do with the freshwater flooding. And that was going to be a big deal for us. So Florence makes landfall as a Category 1 and then moves at only 3 miles per hour as it's moving through Horry County. Basically took all day to do that. And as it's passing, you've got this tremendous flow coming in off the Atlantic Ocean. You're piling up tons of water. Things are moving slowly. You're getting relentless heavy rainfall. And rainfall totals were outrageous. Over 20 inches in our viewing area. Loris got almost 24 inches of rain, which set a record for the most rainfall from a tropical system for the state of South Carolina. North Carolina outdid us with over 35 inches, almost 36 in Elizabethtown. And that is a record for the state of North Carolina for the most rainfall from a tropical system as well. And when you get that kind of rain, there's no doubt you're going to get excessive and catastrophic flooding. And this particular community, the Rosewood community, which is in Sockestee, just a few miles west of us, right on the Intracoastal Waterway, this was the third time in 4 years that they had this kind of flooding. One was from in 2015 when we had the Great South Carolina flood, 16 with Matthew, and then, of course, 2018 with Hurricane Florence. And as you know, you get water in your house, anything from that water line down is basically destroyed. You can hide from the wind, you can't hide from the water. And it was just a devastating scene to see so much flooding in our area. And it's a slow-motion disaster. You initially get hit by the high wind, the heavy rainfall, but then that slow-motion disaster, the flooding, occurs after that. And that could take more than a month for it to actually recede. Stop signs were almost covered as well in Conway. Then we have this. This is the big tornado that came through Myrtle Beach on July 6, 2001. This is looking south from about 8th or 9th Avenue North. That's, or actually 15th Avenue North. That's Pier 14 in the foreground. In the background is the 2nd Avenue Pier. And these piers are north of us about 3 to 4 miles. And that is quite a picture that you see there. Here's the setup of how that actually occurred. Of course, it was very unstable that day. The lifted index was up at -9. Capes with 3,000. We had a cold front moving in from the north and a sea breeze that was heading inland. And right at that intersection, thunderstorms developed. And I'd love to show you the radar, but that thunderstorm right there, lightning knocked out the radar in Wilmington. So, all right, well, let's switch over to Columbia. We can look at Columbia, at least get an idea of what's going on. Nope, they're down for maintenance. So, all right, we'll switch to Charleston. It's so far away, we were shooting the top of the storm. You really couldn't see anything. So we basically relied on citizens and video that they had sent us and the fact that we actually had a sky cam at my weather office, which used to be on 8th Avenue North. So it's the only tornado I've ever seen with my own two eyes. And it literally went right over our weather center. And I did what I tell every child to do at school visits. Make sure you get into a small room with no windows. And once it passed, we went on air with that. So that's how it actually formed. Here's the actual path. About a four-mile path, and you see where Spring Bay Pier is. That's exactly where the tornado ended, so let's get to the video. So at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I had gotten phone calls. Back in 2001, not too many people emailing you. So we see this tornado, or people claim to see the tornado, and we all know how it goes. Every time somebody calls and says there's a tornado, 9 times out of 10, it's not a tornado. But in this particular case, it was. So I went out on the back deck of our weather office on 8th Avenue North and looked north, and I literally saw it coming ashore. It went right over our weather office. I got into my little bathroom there, and then once it passed, got on the news, on the phone with my news director and said, hey, we have a tornado in Myrtle Beach. We need to get on the air. So we did, and our sky cam that you just saw here was the only way we could actually see the tornado. Thankfully, it was moving slowly as it was heading southward, doing the damage. The Bar Harbor just up the road here had quite a bit of damage done to it. It kind of moved in and out of the Grand Strand, sometimes out over the ocean, sometimes over land. It was estimated the winds were about 150 miles per hour, so that made it an F2 prior to the EF scale being released back in 2007, I believe. And this is Spring Maid Resort. That's where the tornado is, literally right back here. And a lot of RVs were destroyed, a lot of homes were damaged, and the resort was damaged as well. So pretty impressive to see that tornado. And amazingly, nobody was killed, and 36 people that were injured in that tornado were actually released from the hospital and had no long-term issues at all. So considering how big that tornado was in the most populated or the most when we have the most people here in the middle of July, it was pretty impressive that we didn't have a lot more damage or more deaths associated with that. So that's kind of my talk. Feel free to take down my information here. If you want any clues to what to do here in Myrtle Beach, you can text me at 742-9815. So I guess if there's any questions, I was on time, by the way.
Yes.
Can't blame me. Thank you.
And you take questions. I'm going to connect them soon, okay? Does anyone have any questions for us?
Wait, do we have a mic? Like in most conferences, we have a microphone where people come up. Somebody want to pass that back?
I don't need a mic.
But the people online, the people that are watching online might not be able to hear you. So, yeah.
As unaccustomed as I am to holding the microphone.
That new pier that they built out there, did they give you any specs on what it's built for wind and wave-wise? Because it's pretty high up. It looks like it's pretty reinforced.
They say it's rated to at least 200 miles per hour. I mean, we'll see if that's going to be the case with that kind of wave, but that's a very good question. The one in Surfside is concrete, so I don't think that one's going anywhere anytime soon.
Hey there. Did you have a lot of backlash about the tornado coming and not getting the warning to the viewers? Were they hitting you for about a week and a half, or how was that?
Well, thankfully, again, there wasn't a whole lot of email back then, so it was more like phone calls more than anything else. But no, we really didn't. I think it was one of those situations where people were kind of surprised, but the damage that was done was primarily the hotels, not necessarily homes that people are living in. So it's a lot of tourists more than anything else. So we really didn't get any backlash from that, I think, because as soon as we did see it, we were able to get on television with the Skycam showing that tornado slowly moving south.
Thank you. All right, we're moving things along. Thank you so much again, Ed, for that amazing presentation. Our next presenter is Mr. Robert Fowler, and he'll be talking about Hurricane Hugo, how far we have come in both technology and population. Round of applause for Robert.
I always says Robert, but officially Rob is, you know.
Okay, Rob.
Good thing is there are no second graders in here. So, you know, normally we're talking to second graders. So it's good to see adults for a change. Hurricane Hugo, then and now. Let's go back to then. I got to Charleston in 1987. When I got to Charleston, the storms that people talked about were Hurricane Hazel in 1954 that Ed mentioned. Hurricane Gracie in 1959, and at a smaller little bit of Hurricane David in 1979. I was lucky enough when I got to Charleston that we had a chief engineer who had just come from Harlingen, Texas, where in 1988 they went through a Hurricane Gilbert. So he came to me in 1989 after I'd been there 2 years and said, we need to review our hurricane plan, and we did. And what we realized was a lot of the people on our hurricane plan were no longer employed by our station. So it was time to dust things off and update and upgrade. And I'm glad we did that because little did we know that 9 months later we would have Hurricane Hugo on our doorstep. And it's hard to believe that coming up on September 21st of this year, we're going to celebrate or recognize the 35th anniversary of Hurricane Hugo. So it's been a long time since we've seen a major hurricane. Downtown Charleston, if you've been to Charleston, Charleston's one of the most beautiful places on this planet. Not so beautiful after Hurricane Hugo. This is downtown. We have an open-air market. Looking down Market Street, this is what it looked like right after Hurricane Hugo. You can see one of the churches in the distance is St. Philip's. We have two main steeples in Charleston. St. Michael's is white. St. Philip's is kind of a brownish color. That's St. Philip's then. This is what St. Philip's normally looks like. So you get a kind of perspective of how dim and dark and gray it was during the time of Hurricane Hugo. A lot of people seem to want to move to the south, and Charleston is part of that. South Carolina is part of that. Our population has exploded, and we don't have many places to put people anymore. We're on top of each other. Our metro population is just under 1 million. We cover about six counties. Charleston, Berkeley, and Dorchester are our three main counties. We serve as Colleton County to the south, and Williamsburg and Georgetown we kind of share with Myrtle Beach to our north. In 1990, right after Hurricane Hugo, the population of the city of Charleston was about 90,000 people. As of 2024, the population in downtown Charleston is 156,000. And since 2020, our population has increased by about 4%. So people are moving there, and that comes into play when we're talking about any threat. And it's not going anywhere except going up. We continue to see the population grow. What's interesting is the bottom line, the green line, is the percent change of population. And you notice we had a dip right around Hurricane Hugo. Obviously, we had a lot of contractors coming in. Many of them stayed, but a lot of people were looking for somewhere else to go. We also lost a Navy base. And when you lose a Navy base, there's a formula that Nielsen comes up with, and it says, because you're losing 30,000 sailors, your market size is going to go down. So when I got to Charleston, we were market size 109. After the Navy base left, we moved down to 119. Charleston is now 88. So to me, that's like a Fort Myer-ish kind of surge in population, that it went very, very quickly in terms of market size. And that brings us back to Hurricane Hugo. Hurricane Hugo, as you know, came off the coast of Africa as a Cape Verde storm, September 9th of 1989. Little did we know that 12 days later, it would be on our doorstep. The steering pattern was pretty much locked in place. In Charleston, if you've been in Charleston for a while, I had a mustache for 20 years. I haven't had it for 17. This is Mustache Rob. And I had to laugh. Yeah, Emily Gracie said, you know, I came to her husband's class probably with Mustache Rob many years ago. But we had a high pressure to the north and east, the Bermuda High. But we had a closed low in the Gulf of Mexico, did not allow that storm to come in. Hugo made a beeline then for Charleston Harbor. I remember Monday before the Thursday landfall, it was coming off the coast of Puerto Rico. We had a summer party at Channel 2, and my boss said, what do you think? I said, let's wait and see what happens after Puerto Rico. And after that, it never, ever deviated off a northwest track, coming right into Charleston Harbor. And what's interesting about that satellite picture, we were on dial-up. So we had to call long distance to get these satellite images. And my boss came to me and said, the long distance phone call bills are off the charts. You've got to taper that down a little bit. I said, no, we've got a hurricane coming. I was dreaming for an I-7 back then. Any Kavaris old timers back then? If you've been to Charleston, we at that time had one way to get onto our barrier island, Sullivan's Island, Isle of Palms. It was the Ben Sawyer Bridge. And you can see what happened to the Ben Sawyer Bridge, the swing bridge. They say, witnesses say, it was twirling around like a whirly bird. Cut off the circulation to the barrier islands. And we have the Isle of Palms, Sullivan's Island. It's pretty well-to-do folks out there, and they wanted to get back home to see if they had a home to get back to. The Army Corps of Engineers and the National Guard did help out, but basically that was our sever. Folly Beach, amazing place, was just about devastated. More beach devastation. And the one picture, the one thing about this picture that jumps out at me is you see how the homes are spaced out? They're not spaced out anymore. It's home, 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 home. So now we don't have the luxury of having places between homes. They're all together. I like to call Hurricane Hugo the first blockbuster storm, and I'll kind of explain that in just a few minutes. Our television coverage was competitive but cooperative. For me personally, it was my first job as a chief. I'd worked in Savannah, Georgia for about 3 years. I moved to Green Bay, Wisconsin for a couple of years. Wonder why. I was a southern boy up in the cold climate, but I met my wife up there. So that was the reason I was there. 2 years in the market when Hugo hit. Hurricane Hugo, by the numbers, $6 billion in damage. I'm not even sure what that would be in 2024 dollars. 935 millibar, 135 mile per hour winds, gust to close to 180, 22 foot storm surge, first major hit in decades. It was the first made for TV storm, and that's why I kind of consider it a blockbuster storm, because CNN had just come on in 1980 and the Weather Channel in 1982, so they were kind of just getting their footing. So Hurricane Hugo was one of the first big storms that they could really show the world what was going on. The local TV landscape, there were three stations. That's it. Cable TV, new to the scene, very small percentage. That was it. My situation was interesting because out of the three stations, one station signed off the air at 4 o'clock. How many people remember when stations signed off the air, played the national anthem? And they did that because they were in a very vulnerable position. And they did get about 4 or 5 feet of pluff mud in their building. Another station that was downtown Charleston, they always flooded where they were, so they decided to leave the air. So at that time, we were the only station on the air for Hurricane Hugo. So there was one source of information when it comes to TV. And for me personally, it was probably the best thing professionally ever happened to me, but obviously personally, it also was devastating. Technology. How many people remember Liveline 2, 3, and 4? Any color graphics fans in here? 16 colors on your Jetstream. Manual graphics. This was probably the worst thing because there was no automation. I literally had to look at the latitude and longitude, put a dot on the live line leading that storm into Charleston Harbor. You talk about pretty stressful? Absolutely. The hardest part was doing that before your 6 o'clock news, because sometimes the data would not come down till late. So you're trying to do that in a pinch. You're nervous, you're stressed, you're anxious, and you're still trying to do that. We also did, remember the probabilities, a little fan that you would put on there? We did that as well. The radar, WSR 57, as in 1957. That's what we used back then. That was it. No Facebook, no Twitter, no live cameras, no viewer pics, no cell phones, no internet, and no selfies. So what did we learn? Have a company plan. Have a family plan. Pace yourself. Believe me, the real work starts after the hurricane. I really feel like we did a good job leading up to the hurricane, and during the hurricane, we did not do a very good job after the hurricane, because I think all of us were shell-shocked, and we had never been through that before. So you've got to pace yourself, because believe me, it's going to go on for days and days, months and months, and maybe in some cases, years and years. Our biggest fear is complacency. The population has exploded in the last 35 years. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. It's going to happen again. Also for us, it's overcoming the I went through the worst of Hurricane Hugo. For Charleston, we went through Category 2 conditions. If you lived in the Bulls Bay area, Francis Marion Forest, you went through a Category 4. That's only a small part of our area. So the bottom line is, for a major hurricane to hit South Carolina, to be honest with you, for the eye to cross over at Charleston Harbor is probably the best place, because the northeast quadrant hit the least populated area. Let's move that eye down to about Edisto, about 20 miles south. Now you're bringing 180-mile-an-hour wind gust into Charleston, a 22-foot storm surge, and Charleston's like Ed said, Myrtle Beach. When someone spits on a sunny day, it floods. So we've got some real issues. Social media. There's so many other ways to get the information. How about this dude? I think he showed up in Harvey. All right? People shared it. He also showed up in Florence and Irma and Matthew. And the one on the bottom left, I think that's Ocean Boulevard in North Myrtle Beach, Ed. So the same guy, people share this. This is one of my favorites. This is actually a real picture of guys kayaking through our market. This was not a tropical system. This was a regular rainstorm that we get. They actually did kayak, but someone was kind of cool and put a little Photoshop to it. And if you're familiar with Charleston, we have these beautiful sweetgrass basket makers. So they put them in a sweetgrass basket. And NBC was calling us trying to find these guys because they wanted to interview them. They thought it was such a cool thing. It's going to happen again. Our return typically is about 8 years for a hurricane strike, but this is where it really hits home. Are we due or overdue? 22 years, generally, we see a major hurricane. It's been now coming up on 35. So we're obviously a little bit nervous. And we found out during Hurricane Andrew, I see Brian Norcross here, all it takes is one. That year, what they had seven storms, and one of them was Andrew, one of only four Category 5 hurricanes to make landfall here in our country. So what's next? Well, according to Dr. Michael Brennan, we had a chance to talk to him recently on the HAT tour, the Hurricane Awareness Tour. We have all the hazards in play here in South Carolina. We've got flooding. We've got tornadoes, surf, rip currents. We got it all. Dave Novak from WPC had a chance to talk to him. He basically says the rain's getting heavier, and that means more heavy rainfall means more flooding. And these pictures, guys, these aren't tropical pictures. This was a storm that we had December of this past year, and it was a nor'easter. And December 17th, we had major flooding. In fact, when you look at the historic crest downtown, you can see it came in at number 4. Every other one had something to do with the tropical weather. And for Charleston, use a baseline of 7, because once we get to 7 feet, we get water in the road. So you can see we had a lot of water. But at the end of the day, paradise comes with a price. It's worth the price, the risk. We live in a beautiful place, and we're very lucky. Oh, how'd my grandkids get in there? I don't know. Questions?
Any questions?
By the way, that's Addie and Reed and Roe. Those are them. Thank you very much. Thanks. It's the best being a papa.
Just out of curiosity, given the, you know, how hurricane coverage is now, you were the only game in town. How many consecutive hours, days were you there being the only guy that was able to broadcast consistently?
So I went 69 hours with no sleep. I'm not a martyr. That's all we had to do. We had a weekend weather person, and she went to Jacksonville, her home, so it was just me. I'll never forget, they finally released me. I was at the National Weather Service in Charleston. I spent the night there. They released me. I didn't know if I had a home to go back to. I drove home. My wife had evacuated to Atlanta, where I'm from, with our son. Well, she was 5 months pregnant with our son at the time. And I laid my head on the pillow, and all I heard were chainsaws. So I didn't sleep for another, I don't know how long, but that's just what you had to do. I don't know if I could do it now, but back then I was younger and stupid and all that good stuff. Yeah. So.
Anyone?
Hi, you said you were competitive but cooperative. Could you expand on that? Did you make mention that your competing stations had to go off the air to evacuate for their safety?
Yeah, you know, I think we all have a situation where we're competitive, and, you know, I like to use the analogy. People ask me, do you get along with Bill Walsh? Do you get along with Dave Williams, the other chiefs in our market? And I always say it's like, you know, when you're a kid, you play baseball and you played against your best friend. On the field, you want to beat them. But when you get off the field, you're buddies again. And I think we had to realize that we're all in this together, man. We had to do what we needed to do. And I felt bad that the other stations had some issues and had to go off the air. But I couldn't really concentrate on that because I knew I had to do what I had to do. But yeah, and we've talked about it. And I obviously the situation I was in 1989 will never happen again, because now there are so many other ways to get information. But back then there was one source of information at that particular time in that particular situation.
One last question, anyone?
Hey, Rob, you talked about, like, on the backside, things didn't go as well as you would have hoped. You know, in the little bit of time we have left, can you elaborate on maybe one or two points?
Yeah. One of the things, Al, that I think was really tough for us to realize is that, you know, the food, the water, the no power, the depression, all of those things really came into play. And we just didn't really know how to handle all that. I'll give you an example. Of planning, the city of Charleston, we had a dry cleaner that came up from Beaufort, who came and basically took all their uniforms back to Beaufort to have them clean because they were soiled, they were wet, they were, you know. So those kinds of things you really don't know how to plan for. And we know in Charlotte, oh my gosh, you guys got 100-mile-an-hour winds in the middle of the night. Even as late as 9 o'clock that night, Ed, it was supposed to go to Myrtle Beach. We were supposed to be on the weaker side of the storm. And I was sitting at the weather service with the MIC, Dick Chanot, and he said, Rob, I got to come on your TV and tell people this is not turning. It's coming right up Charleston Harbor. And we know what happened after that. So thank you guys so much for your time. Thank you. It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Before we bring up our next speaker, just I've been asked to convey, those of you that are standing in the back, we are going to have additional chairs brought in during the coffee break. So I know we're packed, and it's a nice benefit to having such a great turnout, but that's a problem. We don't have enough seats. So we'll have more chairs coming in during the break. All right, our next speaker, and if you sleep like her and me, you see her tweets, who's up with me? 5 a.m. tweet if she's worked the evening newscast. Danielle Breezy is going to be continuing our theme here of covering major weather events, covering the December 9th, 2023 tornado outbreak in Middle Tennessee and Southern Kentucky, and Davis Nolan as well, both presenting for us today.
All right. How's everybody doing? I feel like we're in the beltline of Tornado Alley now, basically, in Tennessee. So we like to present and talk about what we do and how we cover it, just so you guys can see this. This was December 9th, 2023, and Davis, I know you want to mention something about December.
Well, you know, December, this is another one of our typical winter tornadoes that we have in our part of the country, and we have to get used to this. I've been at our station for 42 years, and I haven't got an official number for you, but it just, what was it, 2021, right before that, you know, the Mayfield tornado that occurred. Well, we were just south of there in our viewing area, and we had quite a few tornadoes for that. And so it's very common in our part of the country. It's usually the QLCS type with lots of embedded supercells, and you'll see the supercells embedded here.
All right. So I was going to say, we're just going to show you this through social media, too, kind of how we set it up, and also talk about how we did it on air as well. So we had 8 tornadoes that afternoon, and it was actually an afternoon into evening event. For us, it's mainly nocturnal now. So this was a very unique event for us because we got to visually see a lot of these and confirm them with video sources. So just a little bit about the social media. I'm very big on that. I love to talk about it. You want to make sure you start early on social media and prep your viewers ahead of the event. So obviously the SPC was on to something 4 days out talking about this event. We usually have our morning met, put it on all of our pages in the morning. We also link our website back to it just so we're getting as much viewers aware of the situation. So this was going. It was kind of increasing, as you can see, as we got to Friday morning. Friday afternoon, the threat continues. And then the morning of the event on Saturday, everybody is under a level 2 out of 5.
Yeah, now most of our presentation here is going to be about trying to inform our viewers in a local market. So it's more like that most of this presentation isn't going to be really meteorology. It's more like how we informed our viewers. But I wanted to throw a little bit in because I was looking at the sounding. And the day before, we were looking at the forecast soundings. And, of course, they're just forecast soundings, not real. And I wish I'd written it down. I think I saw a 0 to 3 kilometer storm relative velocity in the 600s, which I don't know if that verified or not. But it was like freaking us out. And sure enough, the 12Z sounding that morning, even though the Cape surface cape was zero at that time and we were 59 degrees on December 9th in the morning, the 0 to 1 kilometer storm relative velocity was already 430 and 0 to 3 was 412 meters squared per second squared. So the worst shear was still going to be coming in the afternoon, and we were already in the 400s for both of those. So it's like, yikes. And we probably, I don't know what cape we ended up with because there wasn't an 18Z balloon, but it was probably between 1,000 and 2,000 later on. Our high that day was only like 68, 69 degrees at the most.
Okay, so, you know, it's always good to have a plan too, right? So obviously we knew this was going to be a big event. Davis works weekend evenings. We had Shelby Mack in the weekend mornings. I was coming in to join them, and we were going to do team coverage. We also had on standby a producer that could go up into the booth throughout the entire day. We had 2 technical people up top so we could be on multiple different screens and going through this. And then we had multiple people come in as the damage started. So going through this, we got the tornado watch issued. And then after the tornado watch, the tornado warnings popped, the first one before noon. And by the way, we are covered by 5 different National Weather Service offices. So it's very confusing, and you have to really pay attention. So our first one was out in West Tennessee. And as this started, Shelby was actually on her own. Now, one thing we may have fudged here or messed up is we didn't have our technical director come in the second one until just after this. So her and I were literally sharing a mic because we could only go on with 1 mic. So that was a little
confusing. Saturday.
It was Saturday. That's what happened. So needless to say, we get to this. This is Montgomery County, a very big populated county, Clarksville, Tennessee.
Fort Campbell,
yep. And I was going to say, and then this is what happened.
Yeah, basically we had this coming through the Clarksville area. We did get it on our own camera, but this is a picture from one of our viewers. Now, we're with a Nexstar station, and they're really big about what we call our UGC forms, which is a release form we have to get signed. And our bosses and producers are pretty strict about it because the lawyers are. And I think I'm hoping, well, maybe Shelby got this one done.
I think it wasn't us.
Anyway, but basically we got that on the air. We're able to split screen. So you're seeing is believing. That's going to come up here in a moment when we have one come through Nashville as well.
So I was going to say, and that's a really big thing to do. If you start to get visual stuff, you want to kind of show the viewer it. If they see that, they're more likely to take the action, right? So we were showing this on the screen. But, of course, it's really important to continue with the street level mapping and talking about points of interest. Now, we get this to go to into Robertson County now, and now we start getting multiple areas and cells that are spinning. And the big one happens is Davidson County, which is Nashville proper. And at this point, we start to see the threat tag considerable come up, and we visually get it confirmed. We actually were using debris tracker or correlation coefficient on air, and we were actually able to see debris being lofted in the air, so we were showing that as well.
Yeah, but seeing is totally believing. And, you know, it's one thing, again, this wasn't a nocturnal situation, so we were able to get viewer pictures, but the Tennessee Department of Transportation, like most major cities, has a camera network. And we had a producer in the booth, as well as our news director, who were smart enough to be monitoring those cameras. And sure enough, one of those Tennessee Department of Transportation cameras catches this on air. I'll let you go ahead and advance that.
We can go. I'm going to show it right now.
I guess it. Maybe try the face part one more time.
Yeah. I'm having technical issues. Yeah. Sorry. Oh, well, that happens all the time, too. Okay. So at this point, you know, we're catching this on camera, which is really crazy. And if you saw in the video here, it actually explodes. So it actually hits a substation and literally turns into almost like a fire tornado and then keeps going. So at this point, you know, I make the call to my producers. I'm like, you need to split the screen. We need to get back on the air and talk about the streets. So I'm going to show you this too real fast.
That's the substation going off.
There it is.
Is changing. We learned that from James Spann, basically, to go on Google Maps and name off landmarks.
You know, I mean, I think that's really good. And that's what I was going to say. If you have teammates, kind of give somebody a choice of what to do for the actual day. So Shelby was on landmarks that day. Davis was in the chat and obviously doing tracking with me. And then I was also doing the main tracking portions of it. Now, I just want to reiterate this. This is at like 4:30 in the afternoon. You saw how dark it got. Okay. So this is very, very scary for a lot of folks. And then we get the thing we never get.
You're calling it tornado emergency, basically. That doesn't happen very often, but when it does, you know things are really serious. Now, sometimes the public doesn't quite understand what that exactly means. We all know it's a huge step up with the National Weather Service to declare a tornado emergency, but I'll let you take it from there, Dan.
By the way, my house is like about a mile on the other side of Old Hickory Lake. I have my 95-year-old mother-in-law and my wife trying to get down in the basement.
I'm literally like calling right now and making sure they're okay. I was going to say, so at this point, obviously, this is where we're getting really serious. We're really worried about it. Eventually, this does lift, but tornadoes continue. I'm going to go pretty quickly for the essence of time. But we have tornadoes spinning to the north, tornadoes spinning to the south. It continues through about 9 o'clock actively. Now, at this point, we've been on the air the entire time. It's becoming more damaged. But every time there's a tornado warning issued, we say to them, you got to get it back to us because it's really important that you drive the coverage. If it's going on, you need to provide the viewers the street names. So we go on until 10:30. We do let people know when it's safe. It's also good to reiterate when it's safe. They're okay. The tornado watch has been lifted. The storms are clearing. And so this became more of a news story by the very end of this. Now, after 10:30, we don't stop, right? Now you go through your emails. Now you go through your Facebook messages, your Twitter messages, and you find out where people, if there's damage, you find out if people have pictures, videos. You respond to the people that are really nice, okay? Don't respond to jerks. Who cares? Ignore them. But the nice people, they took their time to write you. You want to respond to them. It's really important you do that. It goes a long way. And some of that can turn into a proof of performance. We actually use some of those and turn them into commercials where we go out and interview the person. They talk about they were watching us, and that's how we stayed safe. It's also good to show the damage. And as viewers send you in, obviously get the UGC form signed. But, you know, we show those pictures the next day. And I also think it's okay to be human. I was very human on the air that day. I got raw. In fact, when we got the confirmation of three people lost in Madison, I lost it. I cried. I'm getting actually emotional thinking about it. And he hugged me on the air and said, it's going to be okay. We're doing our best. Okay. So just remember, the viewers, if they see that, they take it really seriously and they mean it. So it's okay to be human. At the end of this, we had all these confirmations from 5 different National Weather Service offices come in. So we had to follow them through the next couple of days. And then it's very important to follow up with the event. It's not over when it's over. So that Monday, my 4 o'clock anchor and I went out and did team coverage from Madison, one of the largest hit areas. Now, people were asking me, why aren't you in Clarksville, Danielle? So the next day, I went by myself. They didn't have cameras. I went up there. I volunteered with a lady I did a story with and, you know, went out there and then actually shot video on my cell phone and turned it into a story at 10 o'clock at night. So I became almost like an MMJ. And then, Davis, you did a follow-up.
Yeah, I was curious. They caught this on the TDOT camera, Tennessee Department of Transportation camera. How'd that happen? You know, because the TDOT operators, they usually just look straight at the interstate. And they'll come to find out, I went to interview this lady in the Office of Emergency Management. Now that we know they'll do this, they actually called her and said, can you point this particular camera in this particular direction? So from now on, we're going to be watching because somebody at OEM is going to notify them, and these cameras could be used. So if you're in a market, a large enough market that has this, it's a good idea to keep an eye on these things.
Keep an eye on the cameras and make sure you have a producer or somebody that knows how to find the cameras when you're saying the street names because you don't have time to do that. And then prepare the viewers for the next storm. So we went out. The Sumner County Y got hit by this storm. They asked me to come out and do a lunch and learn of how to stay safe. I did that for multiple Ys, and we did that in a follow-up with we did a roadblock on how to keep your viewers safe and get out to the schools, too. The kids are really important as well. So this is just a wrap-up. I know we're way over, but if anybody has any questions, we'd love to hear from you.
By the way, Danielle's real name is actually Breezy. Her husband's Joe Breezy. I get asked that all the time.
I know, you do ask that. Not the legal last name, but, you know. Okay. Radio stage.
Questions? By the way, tomorrow morning, this was a great putting on tee for me. At 9:30, we're going to be doing a discussion about best practices for social media coverage during severe weather. So we'll all learn a lot from that.
All right. So my question is, what were your thoughts on the new Slack system with National Weather Service having to use 5 different chats? I know we have a lot of Weather Service folks in here. Ooh. I don't mean to take a jab at it, but for us, it seems like it's difficult having that separation between the main chat and the data feeds chat, and I feel like things just get lost. What are your thoughts?
It's really, really, I'll jump in here. It's really hard, and I'm going to do it anyway. Nashville is really, really good, okay? And you know how the old chat, you had everything in one spot. Not only did it ding for us, but you had everything in one spot. In other words, when they put out a warning or some sort of update or a warning, it was there in your chat. We have one of the offices in Kentucky, I think it's Louisville.
you have to go back to their data
feed to find it.
Anything. And it's impossible when you're on the air rapid fire like this stuff, and then throw in five different ones. Now, OHX, those guys are incredible. And so is Memphis and so is Huntsville. Paducah is pretty good, but for some reason, Louisville wants to, I'm pretty sure it's Louisville. I hope I'm not just in the wrong weather service office, and I apologize if I am, but they have it totally separate where you have to go to the data feed.
Oh, and I was going to say this too, when you're going to confirm tornadoes, that's really hard because they do those, public statements and you can't find them. And then you're like, wait, did I miss one? And so we have to go through all the chats multiple times to do it. So yes, it is hard.
Hey guys, great presentation. While we're dissing people, what were your news anchors and your producers doing? I know it's mainly you guys, but I'm just curious how it works at your shop, if they were a help.
I was going to say, who came? Did someone come in?
Oh, yeah, they did eventually. I'm trying to remember.
I forget who came in, but somebody was at the desk at all times. So if it became, if the tornado warning got dropped, then, I actually acted more like the anchor and would send it out to somebody live. And they'd say, hey, we've got this person on standby. They're at this place. Send it out to them when you feel comfortable. So we would do that, kind of throw.
Our regular news weekend news anchor was there.
Yeah.
But when it became a news story, once Nashville got hit, and then when we weren't in the middle of a tornado warning, we were the reporters in the field then. It was really good. Since we knew days in advance of this, our news director was actually in the building himself. We had one of our major producers in the building himself. They're the ones that helped us with those TDOT cameras, mm-hmm. by the way. Which is a major thing, because seeing is believing with your viewers. When they see it, it really means something.
Okay, we have time for one more. And by the way, everybody, introduce yourself before you ask your question so we all know who you are.
Hi, Danielle. I'm Danielle.
Hi, Danielle.
Hi. Now that we're kind of transitioning to more of this digital era, are you streaming on Facebook Live or any streaming apps during all of this too?
Yeah, so we stream on our website for sure, and the digital team takes care of that for us. And then they stream it on our main Facebook page, too. And I don't know if we stream anywhere else. Is that it?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. But the good thing about this one is, like I said, we had people in the building who are not normally there on a Saturday. We had our news director, I think Sebastian, who's our web director.
Our major guy, yeah.
So everything was going smooth. But I've been there on a Saturday before where a tornado warning comes out, and I got to run to the newsroom to tell the one person that's in there, you need to start streaming because I have to get on the air. And if we don't, it doesn't stream, and that's right. Not good.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Moving right along, our next presenter is F. Martin Ralph, talking about atmospheric rivers, overview, and situational awareness communication using the AR scale.
Good morning. Well, now for something completely different. First of all, I just have to say, as a meteorologist for my whole life, being here today, seeing the incredible frontline work that the broadcast community does hand in hand with the National Weather Service, it's a real honor to be in this field and to be with you here today. The situations we face on the West Coast are very different than here. I'm from Michigan. I've lived in Florida. I've lived in Colorado and California. I feel like I lived in D.C. so much, but the needs are very different. I'm going to highlight really a thing for the West. But first, I just want to say, come on, Mayor, tornado went past the hotel. Come on, that's just been crazy. And nobody got killed, thank goodness. Hugo, right down the street. And then this incredible action and support in Tennessee. These are the headline storms in our field, and it's impressive to see what the community here does. The only thing I can really do to sort of stand up to that with something dramatic is my mustache is still here, Rob. 45 years. And my sons wanted to shave it off in my sleep when I was younger. But anyhow, more seriously, I just want to really give a chance to, and thank you for the chance to be here in your community to share this emerging topic, information that's coming along with a real solid science basis. With partnerships with the broadcast community, with the public, with resource agencies, with the National Weather Service, and give you guys just a little bit of a tutorial on where we're at on this stuff. All right. Where's that arrow? There we go. All right. So Mr. Rivers, I'm sure most have been hearing about it a bit, so I'll just give you a very quick tutorial here. You know, this is a beautiful bomb cyclone off the West Coast, extratropical cyclone. You know, how do these relate to atmospheric rivers? Just very quickly in an image, you can see exactly how they relate. This is the streamline pattern associated with that cyclone, and you can see the bullseye, you know, which our field has studied for a century. Thank goodness, because it really is vital to get that right. But down there to the right, look at the purple here, by the way, is water vapor. Here's where the atmospheric river sits. On average, it's 1,000 kilometers away from the low center. And you can get the low right, but not get the atmospheric river right. So this has been really a main thrust of our research for some time, is to figure out how to do that. Because if you don't get the AR right, you're not going to get where the flooding's happening. You're not going to get the winter storms right. You're not going to get a lot of things right in the forecast. So it's vital. It's a necessary condition to get the cyclone center right, but it is not sufficient to get the rest of the impacts right. And we do have a book on it now. There's a whole community of people working on this for 20 years or so. This book has 34 contributing co-authors, international, cross-disciplinary, from resource managers to meteorologists to forecasters, et cetera. So there is a resource out there if you're interested in learning more. Well, they really are literally rivers in the sky. But they're rivers of water vapor pushed by the wind instead of rivers of liquid pushed by gravity on land. And they're much larger, of course, because the density of water vapor in the air is much less than the density of liquid on the ground. But here you see a schematic from a Scientific American article about 10 years ago. And if you slice across it as if it were a terrestrial river and calculate the flow of it in terms of water vapor, an average AR, not even a big one, an average one is transporting 25 Mississippi rivers worth of water. There are only three or four of these in the Northern Hemisphere at any one time, and they are doing 95% of the horizontal water vapor transport. So if we want to predict heavy precipitation, you've got in the cool season, you've got to get the atmospheric rivers right in order to get that extreme precipitation right. And here's an image from satellite, which has helped what catalyzed our understanding scientifically is these pictures. Oh, my gosh, you can see these for the first time in the late 90s, you know, from satellite imagery. That band you can see labeled there, imagine the wind is blowing sort of along the axis of that. That dumped 25 inches of rain in 3 days in Washington State, still one of the wettest storms on record up there. Essentially, all of the flood damages on the West Coast are from these type storms. At the bottom part of that, the purples, is the intertropical convergence zone. These storms are not only vital to flooding, which is really obviously a key thing for the broadcast community, but they are the lifeblood of water supply in the West. If we get too few, we end up drifting down, sliding down into drought. If we get too many, too much back-to-back, we end up in flood. These are the storms that matter for the West Coast. I have to admit, having come from Michigan, I grew up sort of fearful of a nighttime tornado. Seriously, it came into a wedding event I was at as a little kid. Really, I can understand how important they are here. Tornadoes just aren't a thing to really worry about west of the Continental Divide. I mean, I've seen dust devils bigger than an F1, it feels like. But not to diminish the importance of it, but genuinely from an impact standpoint, they are just not as impactful. Hurricanes, same thing. You know, we get some come up leftovers coming into Arizona. I lived in southern Arizona. I saw the impacts of that. The most foolish thing I ever did was walk out into floodwaters from a dying tropical storm in Tucson. I'll never do that again. And then we had Hurricane Hillary hit Southern California last year. And just as a little humbling thing, you know, the media covered that. Substantially. I went and gave a talk the next week, and the AV guy, when I gave him my slides, it was to water managers, he said, are you going to talk about Hillary? This was in San Diego, water managers from across the region, muckety-mucks in that field. And he said, are you going to talk about it? I said, oh, yeah, I'll throw a few slides on it. I went up the mountain and see that and saw it firsthand. He said, well, I want to let you know that my friends and I, we submitted a storm report that the hurricane, you know, moved two of our chairs off the patio. Sorry, but that is the truth of it. It was a big, people there like, well, what was all that about it? People were batting it down the hatches, and it just really isn't as much of a thing there. So one of the striking things already for me in this meeting is the incredible difference between what storms and weather matter west of the divide and what matters here. And I respect a ton what happens here. I moved during a hurricane from west central Florida to central Florida, and never forget it. All right, so back to the script here. So this is what an AR looks like in water vapor and 850 millibar winds, and you can see it's pushing the water vapor on shore. We now calculate the transport of water vapor, how much wind times water vapor. When you integrate it vertically, it's like, if you know river flow, cubic feet per second, it's like CFS in the sky. This is what integrated vapor transport is, IVT. And the color code is sort of what you think it would be. But notice what happens where do you think the precipitation is going to be? Well, of course, it's right where the AR hits. And we know this now. It's just iconic. It's not a surprise. It's literally reinforcing the point. To get the extreme precip right, this map is from the Weather Service on the right, zooms in on California. Those red and yellow dots are in the 4 to 8 inches in 24 hours range. You have to get the AR right in order to get the extreme precip right. Not only are they a thing on the West Coast, but they are on the East Coast as well. This was from a storm this winter. It might even have been the one that was mentioned with the storm surge here that was impactful. And we get big ARs as part of some of these nor'easters. And interestingly, the AR, I keep forgetting, I'm in a really hardcore meteorology group here. You know, latent heating is super important for energizing thunderstorms, right? They're also super important for energizing extratropical cyclones. Guess where most of that energy is coming from physically in the atmosphere? It's from the AR. It's literally the fuel line for water vapor to enter into these storms. And you can get a extratropical cyclone, the very beginning of it happens wherever the baroclinic instability happens. And it might be that there's already an atmospheric river sort of to the south and east of it, right in the sweet spot. We've done a study now that shows when you have an antecedent AR adjacent to where a new cyclone is forming, that cyclone is likely to deepen 50% faster, 50% faster than without it. It's simple. It's because the AR is providing fuel for latent heating to become a bigger player in the cyclogenesis event itself. So for these nor'easters, our hypothesis is, and we're still in the process of testing this and pursuing it scientifically and with the National Weather Service, is that if you don't get the AR conditions right in the Gulf of Mexico that are part of the early stages of cyclogenesis, you're not going to get the nor'easter right. And we've actually got a program started to help with that. All right, we'll keep rolling here. One of the key things is tracking these individual ARs on the West Coast. And you see this AR map, landfall map, the arrow diagram, we call it. And these are very popular with the public and the media, and this shows where the ARs hit during this three-month period in water year 2019. A water year, by the way, is October 1st to September 30th, because most of the precip in the West happens in the winter, so that's easier to track that way. And the color code there is for the intensity of the AR, and the color on land, the green and blue, is, of course, anomalously wet. This is the same three-month period, January, February, March, but 3 years later. California, one measly weak AR in 3 months. This is the heart of the water supply, the snowpack generation season. This was the driest three-month period in the Sierra Nevada on history in that January, February, March. You know, that's the business end of the winter for water supply. This was a serious problem for the economy. The Western economy lives and dies based on water, and these ARs are what deliver it or don't. Flood damages. We looked at 40 years of flood damages. Those red dots, the size of them, are the percentage of all flood damages over 40 years of FEMA data that were associated with an atmospheric river storm. 99% in some of those places on the West Coast. 95%. If you add up the damages across the whole West, 84%. This is from a very important paper by Coringham et al. In Scientific Advances, and it shows quantitatively the impact of ARs as the primary responsible party for flood damages. Now, what is the AR scale? It's a way that we've learned over time that the key parameters that determine the impact of an AR are its maximum intensity, pretty intuitive, but also does it stall over you? Just like Florence here was such a big thing because it stalled. From the beginning of creating this AR scale in 2019, I think the paper is cited right there, yeah, bulletin paper, with seven other co-authors, that it's this combination of these two parameters. And the point of this scale was to create a situational awareness tool for the media, for the public, for researchers, I mean, for resource managers, and for people who have to prepare for storms so that they could know whether it's going to be a big one or not. Because by the mid-2015, 2018 time period, the National Weather Service was getting a lot of questions about, well, is it going to be a big one or not? Because ARs were in the air, so to speak, in the vernacular and people's ideas, always about flood. But the reality is the weak ones are super important to water supply. And if a weak one comes right after a big one, that weak one can put the rivers over the edge. And you got to pay attention to all of that. So in response to that public request for more clarity on whether it's going to be a big one or not, we developed this scale jointly with the Weather Service staff and experts in hydrology and forecasting, et cetera. So this is what it does, AR 1 to 5, and you can see the words there. I won't repeat it because I'm out of time. You can see that nice little graphic there. I want to point out that the damages increase logarithmically with the AR ranking, and this was calculated after creating the scale, which was created based on first principles. Then this calculation, the economic impacts, you know, verified the damage relationship. We've got tools now, our center's developed, that the media has been using at times, from the Washington Post and other print media to TV media. This dot diagram on the coast shows what the maximum AR ranking is going to be in the next 7 days in the forecast. We now have probabilistic tools, way too complicated to describe here, but Chad Hecht in the back is going to be giving a talk on Friday, showing more about our tools from the center, which are used by a lot of people, including Weather Service offices. The horizontal axis in that middle diagram is the week going ahead. The vertical, each bar is a different ensemble member from NSEP. And the bottom graph is a stacked histogram on the right. You see that red goes up about 35% of all the 30 ensemble members said at least an AR5 was going to hit that spot just near San Francisco. And here are the odds. We can now calculate this, including input from the ECMWF. And it ended up being an AR5 on our scale and produced a lot of rain. Finally, we have developed, in partnership with the National Weather Service and U.S. Air Force Weather Reconnaissance Team, atmospheric river reconnaissance program using the same aircraft the nation has for the summer. We use it now in the winter, use them in the winter for AR atmospheric river reconnaissance over the Pacific. You can see the tracks right there. There's a nice schematic showing how we go out and sample with drop sounds. We slice across it. It's like we get MRIs of the AR out there. And that gets assimilated into the global weather models, including the U.S. models. There's a whole slew of publications from all sorts of people that show the positive impact of these data. Improving equivalent by adding these data improves the equivalent of the forecast equivalent to 10 years of model improvement just by adding these data. And we're exploring more and more types of data to include in this. This has become well-regarded as a way to improve forecasts, and it became the focus of a bill introduced by Senator Padilla into the U.S. Senate, the Atmospheric River Reconnaissance Observations and Warning Act. And you can see some colleagues and myself there with Senator Padilla in a Capitol briefing last November, right after which the House approved the bill. The Senate had approved it already, and Senator and President Biden approved it in December. So now we have federal legislation calling for continuation expansion of AR Recon as a partnership between research and Weather Service and NOAA Aircraft Operations Center and the U.S. Air Force Weather Reconnaissance Reserve. And just as a plug, I've seen this a few times where the term atmospheric rivers incorporated into broadcast for public situational awareness. This is a thing in the West that is getting traction, and thank you very much for your attention.
We have time for about two questions.
Marty, Dave Jones with Storm Center Communications. Welcome. I was just wondering if there's opportunities for any of the broadcast Mets that live out west to get on any of the flights to cover it from a media standpoint and really help tell the story.
Yeah, good question. And yes, we've been able to arrange that with the cooperation from the NOAA Aircraft Operations Center. It's something we try to do each winter where opportunities present themselves. A lot of times you got to be sort of on standby. And, you know, the Air Force flights, we can't get the civilians on that. But the NOAA aircraft is flown out of Hawaii. So it takes some lead time and risk to be ready to go, you know, a couple days early and take the trip to Hawaii, which isn't such a bad thing.
Hey, Marty, thank you. I'm Jen Carmagnon from the Weather Channel.
Hi, Jen.
We use the data and the graphics quite a bit talking about ARs. Is there a way to distinguish when there's multiple ARs what each one intensity is forecast to be? Because I think it's a peak in the 7-day time frame, right?
Yeah, the one graphic that I showed with the map and the dots on the dot, that's the peak one in 7 days. But yeah, there are other tools, Jen and others, that do specify it day by day. There's quite a lot of information available on that. So we get a sequence or a family of ARs. And another graph I didn't show here is when you have an AR hit right after a previous AR within the previous 5 days, it increases the average damages by like a factor of two or even more sometimes. Very important to pay attention to the families.
Hey there, Jeff Orgeron, Box 12, Oregon. I'm joined by our chief meteorologist as well, Mark Nelson, who's been in the market much longer than I have. But I just wanted to share some of the, the benefits and also the challenges that we face when we're talking about atmospheric rivers on air. Obviously, it's great to inform the public about what an atmospheric river is. It's categorized by how much water it transports, how long it, the duration of the event. But, we get a lot of negative feedback from viewers as well. We live in a very wet area. Our coastal mountains, the Coast Range, Cascade foothills get over 100 inches of rain per year. Contrast that to the Willamette Valley, 70% of our population lives there, gets 20 to 40 inches of rain. So there's a huge contrast in rainfall. And a lot of that has to do with these atmospheric rivers. They wash out quite a bit over the mountains. They don't tend to bring as much impact, especially even the higher, categories to our Willamette Valley, our big population zone. So I think that one of the challenges that we face, we talk about, major atmospheric rivers coming, and then the feedback is, well, it was just another rain event. I mean, we live in a very wet part of the country. And so trying to explain to our viewers, a lot of which don't live in our mountainous terrain, that these are very impactful to parts of the region, but may not impact, the Willamette Valley. It's something that we face, multiple times a year because we get hit by a lot of ARs. So, that's something that, we face. Do we bring up the term atmospheric river? How often do we do it? It's something that, is constantly discussed on our with our weather team. So just wanted to make those comments.
Well, thank you very much. And we're very much sensitive to that in the sense that the idea of the tool was to create like a heads up. This is going to be one of the storms that could be extra impactful, but it's not meant to be specific to a given spot. That's where the local forecast leaders like yourselves, the National Weather Service, take that information and dial it down to, okay, this is the location that you're for each location. Here's what the impacts are going to be. And then another factor is the one big thing we did not include in the scale was the direction of the AR. And in the west, if that direction is perpendicular to the mountains on the coast, you're going to get hammered. It's just almost guaranteed. But if it's parallel to the mountain crest, it's not going to have nearly as much impact. So I'd love to work together to figure out how to articulate and calculate some of those differences in a way that helps take the next step of specificity beyond the, oh, heads up, this isn't just a run-of-the-mill storm. This could be a much bigger one. That also, by that situational awareness approach, it also helps because some people live in places that aren't so wet, but it could still be impactful for them. Anyhow, appreciate that. Happy to talk offline. Really good points.
Yeah, we're out of time. I mean, we're running so long, we're going to have to you're available during the break for people to come and talk
yeah,
to you?
Yeah, I'll be here tomorrow as well.
Okay, so we're gonna cut into the break a little bit, but we're gonna get one more speaker, and you all know what happened with wildfires last year. I know here in my area in Detroit, we were besieged by the wildfire smoke from Canada. It was a really big deal and caused a lot of problems for people with health issues. So we're gonna take a look at that from a GOES perspective. Chris Schmidt is gonna be presenting for us on that.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm from Chris Schmidt from University of Wisconsin Space Science Engineering Center, Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and I'm here to talk about watching wildfires with GOES. Well, there's a wildfire, and we're watching it with GOES. Thank you for coming to my talk. And if we weren't so far behind, that would even be funnier. That was in New Mexico back in April 2022. That was actually the fault of the Forest Service. They copped up to it. But this is what some of the big ones can look like using NOAA's current operational fire product, which is known as the Fire Detection and Characterization Algorithm, or FDCA, which is based on the thing that I maintain, the Wildfire Automated Biomass Burning Algorithm, the WFABA. You'll hear me use both terms interchangeably because they basically are. And I'm responsible for that algorithm. goes, I'm sure some of you have seen this kind of thing before because I've been giving this talk for a long time. GOES ABI fire detection is possible because it has a few bands that can see fires, particularly that one. Okay. Specifically that one that's highlighted in red. That's the 3.9 micron midwave infrared band. And that one shows the fires earliest and most clearly. However, many others can show fires. In fact, you can see fires in all 16 from the shortest wavelength at the 0.47 all the way up to the 13.7. That 0.47 is blue light, and that really only happens at night when a large propane tank explodes. But it does happen. Every fire starts small, so even though we pay attention to those big fires because they're important, we naturally wonder how small a fire ABI can see either by human observation or algorithm. And in this talk, I'm going to be talking more about human observation. I'd originally hoped to be able to show you some nifty new whiz-bang stuff online that you could actually look at, and it's been taken offline. It's under development by NOAA as part of their next-generation fire system, and they're just not ready for it to be shared in the world. But if you really want to know how to get to it, find me later when I'm in a good mood or we've been out for a while. So I'll focus on Maui. Now, to be perfectly honest, I got in trouble for giving parts of this presentation last August because I made some I will. But the reason being that I was connecting early reports to what GOES saw. But this time I learned my lesson, and I'll connect what GOES saw to the Fire Safety Research Institute's timeline on the fires, so nobody can argue with me about what I say in that respect.
Even though I was right.
So this is the Lahaina fires, Maui fires. On the left, we have the band 2 data, the 0.64, the red. I've got it labeled 0.86 for some reason. I don't know why. And then there's the 3.9 in the middle. And then on the far end is the actual fire product. And basically, the fires are showing up as red or a couple other colors. Now in that middle, you can see all those big black dots appear. They're kind of blurry. That's your fire signature. And it looks blurry because the data is remapped. That's unavoidable for this satellite. But it kind of helps our eye, too, because as soon as that fire signal pops up, you start to see a little plus sign. Excuse me, my mouth is drying up. And so that Lahaina fire, there's a signal earlier in the day. That's the initial AM burn. And that goes away for a while, and then it comes back. Now, that initial AM burn, the product didn't pick up, but the afternoon burn, it most definitely did. And so that's highlighting the location of the Lahaina fire in the middle there. And there's that early morning signature. It just very barely pops up. I can't even see it on that screen. But it's there. And don't worry, I'll highlight on it in another way. So we'll look at that a little more closely using my Pantotip confusion imagery. We have, oh, thank you. My hero. Oh, thank you very much. Here we have that visible imagery again, 2.2 micron, which is considered shortwave infrared. And that will brighten up as the fire gets bigger. And then a scaled version at 3.9, or a scaled to min and max to kind of highlight things as much as we can. On the bottom, there's a difference in the midwave and longwave brightness temperature on the left. In the middle, that's in radiant space for 3.9 microns. And to make it even more confusing, I've got radiant space minus the rolling average of the last 5 frames. Why do I do that? Well, we got great temporal information. Let's use it. And that's the best way to see that AM fire. So it pops up at about 6:36 local time. FSR report said that the fire started at 6:35. And LA Times reported that the calls came in at 6:37. So here, the satellite that's 22,000 miles away picked up this brush fire that was reported on the ground basically at the same time the people on the ground did. Now, I'm not saying that anybody in, say, a forecast office should have been able to figure that out just by looking at GOES imagery. This is my 20 years of experience post-process analysis of it. But it does indicate that there's a future where a satellite like GOES with better optics, and substantially better optics, but it's still possible, could give us monitoring these situations in a much more timely fashion. So here's to set the context. That fire started at Lahaina in that ditch across the street from the school and some houses. This wasn't out in the countryside. So not only did that signal get picked up at the same time people saw it, they were across the street. This wasn't like, you know, somewhere off in the hills and people saw the smoke plume. It was literally across the street and it was still contemporaneous. And basically that little wooded ditch there is where it started. And that's kind of important for this whole sequence of events for the Lahaina fire, because that they thought they put the fire out in the morning and they didn't. And the thing about fires is when you got a wooded situation, woody brush, they can smolder pretty secretly and quietly and give them an opportunity, like, say, changing meteorological conditions, they can burst back up again. And so there's questions about whether or not that was handled correctly, and I'm not one to say, but the crews were reassigned. GOES started to see warming again at 2:56 local time, and FSRI report said Maui Fire Department was dispatched at 2:55 after numerous calls were received by residents who were across the street watching what was going on. Again, very close in time to each other. And as you can see, here's the same kind of loops, and I don't have to show you where the fire is exactly. You can see it pretty clearly, even if you don't really know what these panels are. It is obvious once it gets going. So this is just highlighting that first peak warming. It's not much at 2:56, but it's there. And by the way, the imagery was only every 5 minutes, so we don't really know what happened in between. By 3:21, it was inarguably visible. The operational algorithm picked it up. My algorithm got it, of course, same thing. And what's special about that time? Well, that time was when the fire department reported that it spotted across Lahaina Road into a park and really took off. So it got out of the ditch and got into open ground. And that's interesting in itself, but the fact that it corresponds so well with ground observation is another important thing to note. So as important as it is to know about those early starts and these big fires, we're trying to really understand what is the smallest fire we can see with GOES. And as we get into that question, we need to re-examine what we mean when we talk about size. We usually think of them as a planar black body when we talk about fire size. So it's a 300-acre fire. Well, we're measuring the flux from the flames, the chemical process of combustion, that volume of gases that's released by the heat-driven pyrolysis as the fuels are decomposed. And what the satellite's most seeing is that flame. It's not seeing the stuff on the ground so much. There's energy there, but most of it's the flame itself. And so the size of that flame is what matters, the volume and intensity of that combustion is what matters, not the ground size so much. And it also matters what's absorbing or screening that light. So a fire down in a ditch, you're not necessarily going to see it as well simply because you may have something blocking the view. Even if it's the same fuels that are burning, they may screen, say, half the energy out from your viewing point. But can we put numbers on that? And what's that smallest fire, isn't it? Well, it's very context dependent. So we need to know, to get at that, we need to know when and where fires started, the fuel and weather conditions, and have a full record of the fire's behavior. And there really isn't that information, except from something like GOES, at least as far as behavior over time. But we do have the prescribed fire community out there, and they are keeping records of their work. And we can use that as a way to start getting at what ABI can and can't see. So I got connected with the Illinois Prescribed Fire Council last year, and they have this huge database they've been keeping over since 2016 or so, which is convenient because that's when the satellite was launched. And they make they have this database made available to me of GIS data of all these prescribed burns. Now, it just dates and perimeters. It doesn't have start times, unfortunately, but it's a start, especially if I can show there's value. People I've already talked to have indicated they're certainly interested in putting more time into recording start times and whatnot for this work. So I selected a subset from February and March of last year. It's just 110 fires in Cook County, Illinois, ranging from a tenth to 500 acres. And I looked at the imagery by hand. So that's why it took a while. Positively identified out of total, 43 out of 110. Doesn't sound so great, but there were a lot of clouds. So positively identified on cloud-free days, 15 to 19 to be conservative, being more forgiving, was all of them. See all of them. Positively identified likely cloud-free scenes on days that were otherwise had clouds, since we don't really expect start time, 8 out of 20. Really, if you could see it because of cloud conditions, pretty much every burn you saw, unless it was literally the garden that they were burning, that's where those 0.1 acre things came from. So here's one example, a prescribed burn in a forest reserve, 323.8 acres. These aren't big, intense fires. They go pretty slow. But we caught it. We saw it with GOES, with algorithms, and hurrah. Here's a case where we didn't see it at all, and it was a burn in Bussey Woods, almost 100 acres. Same people did it, same types of practices, but we didn't see it at all. Well, we had clouds and we had the woods themselves. You can see that outline is pretty much right over the wooded area and only a little bit's tree free. So the woods were screening a lot of it. Even though the leaves were down, it still wasn't pretty visible. So here's some resources to see the GOES data. This doesn't have the fire data I was hoping to show you maybe next year. I've been saying that for a decade now, and I'm not kidding. Yeah, I'll leave that up for a moment and then switch to the last slide to see people taking pictures. Anyway, there's my contact information, and thank you very much.
We have time for just a question or two really quick. And while McCall is coming down with the microphone, we are going to be resuming at 10:30. We've just cut into the break, so... make it a quick one, everybody. We'll be back here at 10:30. 10:45? Oh, I've been corrected. 10:45. All right. Well, we do have questions.
Sorry, I'm only over. I work for NOAA, National Severe Storms Laboratory at OU. Have you looked at other databases of prescribed fire from other land management agencies?
Oh, yeah, there's others. Yeah. So there's out there. It varies quite a bit on what's available publicly. It's really a networking question at this point, making connections to people and getting that sorted out. So.
Hey, Chris. Dave Jones. I was just wondering, for those of you in the room that are broadcast Mets with their weather systems, do you get these different channels into your weather systems? And if you don't, I know you put up the resources, yeah, but if you ask and call, you know, NOAA and say you need this data and you tell your weather vendors you need this data, perhaps it will, you know, be delivered to you. And the other thing is, Chris, I just want to ask, with the emergence of AI, how do you see AI contributing to setting off little alarms or something that can turn the attention to the broadcast Mets to something happening in their area?
AI might be useful when it comes to handling actual detections. Doing the detections themselves, AI has proven to be pretty miserable because the signals are small. It's not what AI is suited for. But when sorting out all the information that helps you decide what is and isn't relevant, that might be a place for AI. I do see one more question from somebody.
No, because of the break. Before we break, broadcasters, as you saw with the presentations, is about covering big weather events. If you have a big weather event coming to your area, prepare in advance to archive your video, your social media. Come give a talk at our conference next year. I want to have a session every year about covering big weather events. We can all learn from each other that way. So think proactively in that regard.
All right, thanks, Paul and McCall, for that. You guys, we're going to be back at 10:45, and just speakers, be cognizant of the lights for your timer so we can stay on time.
It's across the hall. The coffee is across the hall. All right, looks good. This is his last slide because he's going further, so you just have to hit escape. Always wait.